There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go?
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous.
Shirley Strawberry with us, and she is the author of The Strawberry Letter. She's one of the most recognizable names and voices in radio today, dubbed the best voice in radio by Steve Harvey. This native Chicagoan knew even as a young girl that being a radio personality was her destiny. But what she never imagined was that one day she'd be sitting in the co-pilot seat of one of today's biggest and strongest and nationally syndicated radio morning shows in the country with nearly 8 million listeners. Shirley, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Michael. How are you? Thanks for having me. What an introduction.
By the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, when you talk about someone writing a book, usually what I have found over the years, Shirley, that whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, what that book is that internal person coming out, and it gets expressed through words. And let me ask you this before we truly get into the book, The Strawberry Letter. This happens to everybody who's an author. There's somewhere in that book that aha moment hits. That's something about a dimension of the book that you didn't realize, or yourself, you didn't realize was there before. Where was that for you in the writing of this?
Well, I guess it was when I decided to just let it all go, to not try and cover up anything, to not try and hold anything back, to just say, I'm going to tell it all. I'm going to be open and be transparent, which is difficult for me because I'm a very private person. But I thought the way to really connect with our audience and connect with the people who listen to us, nearly 8 million people every day, was just be transparent and let them know that I'm just like them. We all have a story. We all go through things.
Now, The Strawberry Letter in and of itself, the core of it, what is the purpose of the letter?
Well, the purpose of the letter, really, Michael, is for our audience to call in, to write in, and to get advice from Steve Harvey and myself, to simply get advice about relationships, mainly women write in about their bad or horrible relationships with their husbands or their boyfriends, things like that. From time to time, we get letters from young girls or young men who are going through things, maybe just growing pains in life and things like that, things that will really touch you. But mainly it's relationship letters, and they write us because they want our advice on what to do. Imagine that.
Now, Shirley, let me ask you this, because it's fascinating when you think about this. How long have the letters been there? How long have you been doing it?
Well, since the inception of the Steve Harvey Morning Radio Show, which was 2000, when we first started the show, it was a local radio show in Los Angeles. And there are a lot of morning shows in Los Angeles, if you can imagine, Michael.
Sure.
We wanted to do something that would separate us, that would make us stand out and make us different than all the other radio shows. So we came up with The Strawberry Letter. My last name is Strawberry. And there's a hit, I'm sure you've heard it before, by the Brothers Johnson, and it's called Strawberry Letter 23. So that was kind of where we started from. And we said, why don't we get our audience to write us letters? We'll answer them and as far as advice goes. And the letters have taken on a life of their own, and it's like our little radio soap opera now. Everybody tunes in to listen to The Strawberry Letter.
You know, let me take you back a bunch of years, because I think this is, you know, when you deal with something like The Strawberry Letter, if you were to go back you know, 15, 20 years ago. You've been doing this going on almost 12 years now. But the culture changes. And as the culture changes, the society changes and problems are different. Have you found that the problems in the letters over the last 10, 11 years have changed any? Have they moved towards a particular theme in a letter that people are having problems with? Have you seen the letters change as the culture changed?
You know, Michael, that's a very interesting question, but I have to say that it doesn't seem like relationships have changed that much. The basic core of my man won't commit, my woman is cheating on me, my man is cheating on me. It seems like those themes have been the same throughout the years. We may get more letters now about women cheating if you talk about culture changing.
Sure.
But basically, it's the same relationship type issues.
Do you think they'll ever get it out there? And when I say they'll ever get it, people have tremendous problems in relationships. And I what I've seen over the years is they don't start them out right. They have no idea. You and I meet, we're going to get into a relationship. I am supposed to know about you. I am supposed to know how to treat you, what you like, what you don't like. And that's not so as a man and woman. We don't sit down and ask anymore. And I really believe if you sit down at the table, values neutral, come in and construct that, you know, how do you receive love? How do you like to be kissed? And those kind of things, then I think relationships would last a lot longer. What do we got, a 55% divorce rate in the first year now?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. We do need to slow down. Women need to slow down. Men need to slow down. Everybody's trying to jump in bed. Everybody's trying to skip over the steps. These are rules that have been in place for centuries. You cannot skip over these steps. You have to get to know a person. You have to fall in love with the person, or you should fall in love with the person. You have to do these steps that go with it. You need to court the person. You need to be courted. As Steve so eloquently put in his book, Steve Harvey, you have to, as women, lay out your rules and your standards. You have to do these kinds of things, your requirements. You have to do these things. You cannot skip over these very important steps that have been in place for centuries.
No, absolutely. And I go back to a time that this is between you and I. Don't tell anybody. I go back to a time. Okay. But I go back to a time, way back to the Doris Day movies, right? And the rule at the time was if there was going to be a bedroom scene, 1 foot on the floor. Now, I'm not a moralist, but I'm also a pragmatist. And things have changed so drastically that I imagine there are certain problems inherent in relationship today that really don't have to be there, but they come with the culture. They come with that very quick run, microwavable kind of life that nobody has time for anything. And the other thing I think we have a major problem with is texting and the high technology. What happened to the human touch and human presence in the relationship?
Yeah, we talk about that a lot. Why is it that texting is so fast? Why is it that you don't want to hear the sound of a person's voice anymore? Why is that you don't want to look in their eyes across a dinner table with some candlelight burning? Why don't you want to do those types of things anymore? Why are they considered corny in today's culture, as you put it, Michael? Why is that not cool anymore? Why is it cooler to text someone or to tweet them on Twitter? what is wrong with us? I don't get it. I mean, you know, women love to dress up and look pretty. Now it seems we're dressing up and looking pretty for each other, not for the man, because if they do like it, they may not even tell you anymore. They might text you and say it to you. But you want to hear the sound of their voice. You want that human touch. You want that human contact. That is now becoming a lost art for some reason. I don't know what it is. I wish I did, but I don't.
But realistically, when we take a look at it, I think the definition of love has completely changed. And when two people meet today, it's a different world. It's a whole different ball game. I got divorced in 2002, and she's a wonderful woman. We still talk, but it was one of those things after 18 years, it was over. We both knew it. And I stayed in the house, and I'm standing in the bedroom one day, and I had a little bit of a hard time because I was the one who stayed with all the ghosts, quote unquote. You know, I could still hear her coming up the steps and so on and so forth. Excuse me. So I'm standing in the bedroom, and there's a bookcase there. And I'm telling you, this is the absolute truth. Something fell out of the bookcase. It was on a pink piece of paper. To this day, I have no idea where it came from. I have no idea what book it could have come out of. It just fell. And I picked it up, and it said this: "May you have enough happiness to make you sweet, enough trials to make you strong, enough sorrow to keep you human, enough hope to keep you happy. The happiest people don't necessarily have the best of everything. They just make the most of everything that comes their way. And giving someone all your love is never an assurance that they'll love you back. So don't expect love in return just for it to grow in their hearts. But if it doesn't, be content it grew in yours." And I still have that today, and I still don't know where that came from.
That's beautiful. That is absolutely beautiful. Those are words to live by, for sure. I don't know what to say about the state of love and the state of the human condition as it relates to relationships and how we relate to each other. I can only say that each person who feels the way we do, you and I, Michael, if just each of us can do our part, maybe it can make a difference. You know, if we have children, we have to instill that in our children. We have to continually instill that in people that come after us and let them know, this might be the way it is now, but it isn't the way it should be. This is how it should be. And let's try and get back to that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the roles of men and women have strayed from what they used to be. It's almost as if you, as a man, if you want to open a car door, open a door for somebody, you're almost afraid to do it. You're going to get one or two reactions. One is thank you, and the other one is back off. I can do it myself. So that's something that didn't happen 10, 15 years ago. There was a story I've told on the air a couple of times, and it made so much sense. Radio Susie and I had a business appointment downtown in the Milwaukee area. And we got to the front door of the building, and I opened the door, and I stood back, and Susie walked through. And there was a young woman on the other side of the door, probably 30, 35 at the very most. And I stood there and I held the door open for her. And she walked out the door. She looked at me. She had tears in her eyes. And she said, "People don't do that anymore." So it's just that little bit of do something, pay it forward. And it's just that little bit of a gift that you can give somebody. Take the time and do it. And who cares what somebody thinks?
That's right. That's right. I believe in being an example. I have a 14-year-old daughter. I just believe in being an example to her, if nothing else, because kids go by what you do, not by what you say. And I just want her to know that there's so much more to life than what you're doing right now. Of course, you have to go to school and get your education, but there's so much more. I mean, you have a chance to have real happiness in life. You really do have a chance. And I think perhaps if we keep putting the message out there, Michael, like in the Strawberry Letter and in other works and what you're doing with your show and everything, I think things are cyclical and it will come back around. It just may take time. And I could be an idealist. I know I could be very idealistic at times. But I'm just hoping that it will, because I have a daughter and I want her to experience all that a good relationship has to offer.
Yeah. Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time, but I have your book in front of me, which I'm going to read page by page. But in looking at the picture, your picture on the front cover, I got you down. You ready for the word, the descriptive word here? The smile?
Yes, I am.
Mischief. Charlie Strawberry, before we go, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, you can go to ShirleyStrawberry.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter at MyGirlShirley.
Wonderful. Hey, Shirley, thank you so much for joining us.
And text me sometimes, Michael. Why not?
Absolutely. Okay, good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Girl, the hole in my arm.
and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Where are you with a love oh so true and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old? Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll
hear. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
She'll bring her love to me, dream lover, until then.
Lynette Louise with us. She's the author of Miracles Are Made, a real-life guide to autism. She's a performer. She's an author. She's a mom and an autism expert. Board certified at neurofeedback. She travels internationally performing on the subject, and she teaches children and families, and she also speaks professionally. Her one-woman show, Crazy to Sane, shines a bright light on healing autism. And again, she's the author of the inspirational book, Miracles Are Made, a real-life guide to autism. And let's say, Lynette, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you for being here. You know, I've got the book in front of me, and I also have the DVD, the Crazy to Sane. Let's go to autism for a moment. Let's define it practically. Through your eyes, how would you define autism?
Through my eyes? Oh, that's interesting. Well, I would agree with most professionals in that I would say that it's a social disorder, a communication disorder, and there's repetitious behavior. Where I might veer a little bit, so you have to have those three things in order to really be considered autistic, but within those, of course, you need to have degrees of difficulty. Where I might be a little different than some professionals is I think that the social disorder and a repetitious aspect of it come from a sensory problem, a confusion of the sensory system that forces the child to focus on and be interested in different things.
Okay, so the confusion, is there a disconnect?
Right, like, for example, I'm going to give you an example because I had a sensory integration disorder when I was a child, so it's easy for me to speak from the first person on this, although it's just an aspect of what an autistic person might deal with. At least it gives me sort of a window in, a little peekaboo. And when I was a child, if you played the piano or music came on the radio or especially the cartoon music, I would see the sound as color. So it's the my visual system and my auditory system were confused. And this can happen in many, many ways. Some children taste shape, for example. So they, you know, you give them soup and they say, well, there's too many squares in here. So it can be a very unique and interesting world that a child with autism or a sensory integration disorder is afflicted with.
And through your eyes, I imagine you see children differently than most people do. You raised 8 kids, 6 adopted, 5 disabled, 4 on the autism spectrum. So your world was built around seeing what most people don't see. And when I say that, I've done a lot of shows on autism over the years, and one of the things that I have learned, and I'm no expert, believe me, but one of the things that I have learned is there are other things that people can mistake for autism, and maybe that child isn't diagnosed properly in the beginning, and that could be a problem for the bulk of their life.
You know, I was really, really, really blessed when I found neurofeedback, because as a mom, I spent an awful lot of time saying, why, what? Is it autism? Isn't it autism? I had 2 kids that were high on the spectrum, and at that time they didn't even have a spectrum. So, you know, one was infantile autism, another one's PDD, another one has autistic-like mannerisms, and the another one has about 72 diagnoses. And so it was a very difficult and confusing time, especially back then when they knew even less than they know now. What was really awesome for me is when I got to stop caring what you called it.
in order to help it. Yeah. And I think it's why once I discovered neurofeedback and began working with it on myself and on my children and on other people's children, and I saw it make so much difference, I just felt like I had to bring this out into the world in a way that could shout it out from the rooftops and say, hey, everybody should have a shot at this because it's quite impactful. It's quite amazing.
And what we're dealing with also, the word cure, obviously, it doesn't really apply to it. It's called management, isn't it?
Well, you know, people, I love this question of cure. I just love it because if you have something like Down syndrome, for example, then everyone knows you're always Down syndrome and that maybe you can get better and better at different things and you might have a low IQ, you might have a medium IQ. Nobody questions the Down syndrome piece. They just question where is your functioning level. When it's something like autism, where we don't actually know exactly where it's coming from, although we have a lot of proof about a genetic predisposition, we still haven't really got a test like we do with something like Down syndrome. So we'll say, you know, you can't cure Down syndrome, you can help Down syndrome. But a lot of people will say, well, you can cure autism. For me, I go, well, if they're no longer acting autistic and hitting the diagnostic criteria, as long as we don't have an actual laboratory test to define it with, then I guess you could say they walked off the spectrum and now they're just in the weird zone. It's a really controversial question.
Yeah, but realistically, the word cure, you know, I don't even know what that means anymore for a lot of things. If you can have something and it gets into the manageable range, then why not? As long as you can live a decent life and maneuver through life the way you would like to, whatever your capabilities are or aren't, and there is a base understanding with those that support you and that are around you, then life can be good. I'm sure that there are autistic kids and people that have wonderful lives, and their lives are better than most people running around with all kinds of problems. So to the degree, as you were speaking, but the point of contention is once you can get anything under that veil of management, then life is palatable.
Yeah, but Michael, okay, so we all believe that the brain is plastic. Everybody goes around saying the brain is plastic, the brain is plastic. Look, if you have a stroke and your left arm doesn't work, if you tie up your right arm, you can get your left arm working again, and what happens is the brain heals itself and it grows again. So we can't say on the one hand the brain is plastic and it heals, and on the other hand we can only manage a disorder. The fact is, you know, I had kids that were, you know, really challenged, and now they're not.
Yeah.
You know, my one son is a helicopter mechanic. He went to Kuwait and back. He's a sergeant. He's now in Iraq and back. He handles all of that stress and does really well. My other son's been independent, buying a house, had the same job for a long time. I mean,
do we want to
call it autism or not?
But wait, isn't that managing life?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's managing life. It's so nice, though, if we can just say, this is part of his history and his story, and at some point he became a good manager of life, so I don't know that he really deserves to have a diagnosis that would inhibit him out in the world.
Oh, boy, you know, when you really come down to it, Lynette, if you think about this, there are people out there that don't have autism that can't manage life.
That's true. That's why I think my children are so amazing.
So realistically,
it's just fantastic.
Yeah. If you get people with challenges, they get brought in with challenges, and they overcome the challenges and they manage what they have, that's powerful stuff. What a lesson and a legacy for those that come after them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, it's really quite wonderful to realize that you can, no matter what you were given at some point in your life as far as a label or a life story even, you know, what you grew up with, if you can step away and just be someone who owns your own life and is in charge of your own life, that's huge.
No, absolutely. And most people are not in charge of their own life. Most people are waiting for someone else's opinion of what their life should be like, and we don't have to go into it. You know the story. And that's what I'm going to go back to some of these challenges. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes those very challenges, the autism, the whatever the case may be, in certain cases, could be the best thing that ever happened to them. Because look at how they grow as people within.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Oh, yes, being challenged by life is just, it's a blessing. It gives you some kind of an answer to what am I focused on. You know, the person who just gets all the gifts and runs around going, I don't know what to take in college, I don't know what to be, I don't know, they're actually very uncomfortable. When life presents you with this is your thing and this is what you're going to work on, you can be very lucky, but it can also be extremely hard. So,
sure. No question.
Both sides of the coin.
But there's something that happens, though. It's called support. And if they have the right support, they don't have to hide. And there are too many people who hide today. And it is about collaboration, because when somebody in the family has autism, the entire family has it. Maybe not physically, but you're all affected by it. We're all affected by it. And so the real key is it's that support mechanism that helps them come through. Would the kids be doing what they were doing without your strength?
Oh, no, absolutely not. In fact, yeah. I needed the whole actually, I want to tell you a very short story that really made a difference for me that applies to this. So my son's at this time, he's like a big guy, and he's, you know, 16, nonverbal, loves to jump and scream if he sees old people because he thinks it'll scare them, and that's fun. And so he's hard to take out at this point in the story. And of course, I take him out anyway because I figure, well, he's not going to learn how to not do this if I don't take him out. It's especially challenging in grocery stores. I tell this story often because it was such a big moment for me. So I take him to the grocery store again, and I'm, you know, sort of shopping going, please no old people, please no old people, please no old people. You know, and I'm watching him. And my daughter is beside me. And at the moment that I see his body do the contortion, that means he's about to jump and scream, which means he's sighted someone before I have. I'm about to stop him, and my daughter takes my attention. Well, he jumps and screams, and old man turns white, and it's all a very difficult second or two. And I'd, at this point in raising the kids, I had come to be the mom that was always controlling everything, trying to stop everything so the neighbors would like us. Well, he jumps and screams, the guy turns white. My daughter giggles and says, oh, that's okay. That's how he says hi. The guy's color comes back in his face. I'm kind of dumbfounded. She says, hey, you can shake his hand. His name is Dar.
I love it.
It's so beautiful because he spent the rest of the grocery store trip running around trying to see an opportunity to wave to Dar and go, hi, Dar, hi, Dar. I'm not afraid. And I realized something that I'd never known. And that was that, you know, I had been pretty angry with the way people treated my child. And this is a common problem for moms. And in that moment, I realized it was because they were looking to me to model how they should be with my children. And I was modeling tough.
Yeah.
So no, all of a sudden, I could model kind. And guess what happened?
Yeah. The beautiful. World turned around.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
totally.
And the little ones taught you a lesson.
Absolutely. And I got them the opportunity to model that lesson for others.
Yeah, and isn't it interesting where the lessons come from? You never know when you're going to learn. It can happen out of the clear blue and just a roll of the dice.
Totally. Totally. No, it's for me been one of the greatest blessings ever is that I adopted all these children that needed special attention so that I could figure out myself, really, and my own life.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, it is you. And when you think about that, all those things that you have around you, is you. You adopt the kids. It's all about, when I say not, it's all about you. You're helping them and it's about them. But they're a reflection of who you are. And as you build, then you can see as they go. And if the model is there and they grow and they become better, they become fuller, they become more, so do you.
Absolutely. No, totally. And bigger and bigger and just freer. And isn't that funny? Because so many people see autism is a prison, and there certainly are moments, I have to say, when I was raising the kids, there were many moments when it felt like that. But, you know, at the end of the day, it was actually my wings, my ability to fly.
By the way, the people around you, your own family, if there's any brothers, sisters, moms, dads, etc., how were they with this? How did they react?
Supportive at all. they totally disappeared. And in fact, I went through five husbands. I'm very colorful.
That'd be fun.
No, I had to do it all myself. But here's the really cool thing. My children, so I had four children that were not autistic, although one was learning disabled, they were not autistic, and then four that were autistic. In the four that were not autistic were older, and they became so integral in helping their brothers and buddying with them, and like in the story at the grocery store, showing me the way, really. And now at this point, we're this enormous support system. In fact, you heard about me because my daughter sent you some information on me.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yes. I've got a lot of the information, and we were looking forward to the interview because I think in and of itself, there's a lesson to be learned because there's so many families that give up, and they give up for one reason and one reason only. It's not what they don't know. It's what they don't know that they don't know, and they don't get exposed to those people who have, you know, you fall down, you get back up, you fall down, you get up, and you learn, but at least you have the strength to go through it. And that's your legacy, and not necessarily even for the kids that come onto this planet with autism, but for the moms and the dads and the relatives of these kids, because there's got to be a strength all the way across the board. I'm going to go back to where I was. It's collective. If one person in the family has it, everybody's got it.
Oh, and if I were to give a gift, in fact, moms should go and get a pen right now so they can write this down, moms and dads and sisters and brothers, and just put it on your fridge. Because if I were to give a gift, it's to say, everybody learns.
Yeah.
Everybody learns. So don't let somebody tell you your child won't learn. I can't tell you if they're going to learn at the pace of a snail or the pace of a speeding rocket, but everybody learns.
Now, by the way, your one-woman show, The Crazy to Sane, okay, that for you was an outlet, wasn't it, or isn't it?
Well, it's kind of both. It was, first of all, I was raising the kids doing performing. I had a TV show. I did stand-up comedy. So it was kind of a natural for me when I found neurofeedback to go, wow, I really want people to find out about this. How do I do that without just being like everyone else and hitting them over the head? So I created a show where I get to sing and dance and be funny, but also impart this inspirational story, this information, in a new way, in a form that other people don't. And by the way, I'm at the Comedy Store April 23rd at 7 o'clock. And the first 20 people that write in on my website and put your Dresser After Dark on it, I will give a free ticket to.
Wonderful. Wonderful. By the way, I haven't been back to Los Angeles for quite a while. 713, what area is that?
713 is actually Houston. I raised my kids in Canada and then in Texas. A few of them are still in Texas, and they don't have a lot of money for long distance. So I just kept the number for so long. Now long distance kind of doesn't matter. But
that's a good thing. I was raised in Los Angeles, so that was a time when there wasn't much about L.A. and the area that I didn't know about. The show itself, are you all over the country with it?
Yes, I'm going to Kansas tomorrow. And I'll be doing it in Kansas. I was just in Berlin. I did it Canada, international, actually. I just happened to be doing it at the Comedy Store in L.A. On the 23rd, but I hardly ever do it in California. Usually I'm doing it on the road.
Yeah, then by the way, California is not the same old California that it was 150 years ago now. But being
not that old.
Well, maybe 106. But it's a whole different world. But being on the road has got to be an interesting way of life. Most people think that it would be too tough to do. But if that's what you do, and that's what you love, and that's what you enjoy, then it's just a part of life.
Oh, hey, and I work in people's homes. So traveling is a part of this. If I want to really help families, having them come to me takes them out of their environment. I don't see as much. I'm not as useful. So I travel all the time also because I go into people's homes. I help them learn how to do the neurofeedback, how to change how they are with their children. I do shows. It's really awesome.
Okay. Now, by the way, neurofeedback, which is what?
It's biofeedback for the brain. So you've probably seen or heard of it in some form on television or something. You put a sensor on the head and you're looking at the EEG, and the child runs a video game with their brain waves, no hands. It sounds very difficult, but, of course, we set it up for success so that they can run the game and then slowly adapt. And it allows the brain to change at a faster speed than you could do it simply through hugs and kisses and lessons. So it's just another way of helping the brain shape towards a more balanced state so that the children are available to learn.
Okay, so effectively, there are many ways to look at this. Everything from mom loving somebody and holding them to something scientific where you're actually working with biofeedback, working with the brain, and getting that quote-unquote disconnect, whatever that is, or that confusion, back into some kind of order. Now, and the kids, the boys, now they had autism, and I don't know, so I'm asking. Lynette, can you say they had autism or they still are autistic living a life?
I would say they're no longer on the spectrum. As long as autism is decided by a diagnosis that says, do you do this, do you do that, do you do this, do you do that, if they no longer hit that diagnostic criteria, then they would be off the spectrum of autism and no longer autistic. That's how I would say it. And I think that that's correct in that without a laboratory test to point to whether it is or it isn't, you'd have to say, well, they're not living autistic, so therefore they're not. Mm-hmm. It would be the same with something like ADHD. If you have a serious focus problem and you no longer have a serious focus problem, well, do you want to still be called ADHD if you don't have that problem?
That makes sense.
You know, I say they're off the spectrum except for one. I have one son who's he was extremely damaged. He's kind of the star of the book. I tell a lot through him, his life story and his story and trying to work with him. He's been my main motivator because the other kids I could change and help more easily. Things that we naturally do to love our children into healing were easier to work with all the other kids than with Dar. And so I needed a scientific modality to really help Dar begin to talk. He was 23 before he started to talk.
Yeah. What a way, huh? We're about out of time. Lynette, do you have a website we can find you and track you and find out everything you're doing and buy the books?
Yes, LynetteLouise.com. And I will also give, if they send an email with Dresser After Dark, the first 10, I will send out free books.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much. Great job you're doing. And just go out and get them.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. Good night.
Okay, good night.
To be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all.
There's a story told about a soldier who finally came home after having fought in Vietnam. And he called his parents from San Francisco and he said, Mom and Dad, I'm coming home, but I've got a favor to ask. You know, I'd like to bring a friend with me. I've got him with me and I would love to have him come home. And they said, sure, you know, we'd love to meet him. And the son said, well, you know, there's something you should know. And he said he was hurt pretty badly in the fighting and he stepped on a landmine. He lost an arm, he lost a leg, and he's got nowhere to go, and I want him to come home and live with us. And they said, I'm sorry to hear that, son. Maybe we can help find another place for him to live. And the boy said, no, Mom and Dad, I want him to live with us. And the father said, son, you don't know what you're asking. Someone with a handicap like that would be a terrible burden on us. You know, we've got our own lives, and we can't just let something like this interfere with our lives. And I think you should come home and forget about this guy. You know, he'll find his own life. And at that point, the son hung up the phone. Now, the parents heard nothing more from him. And a few days later, however, they received a call that the San Francisco police, their son had died after falling from a building, they were told. And the police said they believed it was suicide. The grief-stricken parents flew to San Francisco and were taken to the city morgue to identify the body of their son. Now, they recognized him, but to their horror, they also discovered something they didn't know. Their son had only one arm and only one leg. And the parents in this story, like so many of us, we find it so easy to love those who are good-looking, they're fun to be around. But we don't like those people who inconvenience us or make us feel uncomfortable. We'd rather stay away from those people who aren't as healthy, as beautiful, or smart as we are. And thankfully, there's some people who look through those things. And there's some people who look at what's inside instead of what's outside.
Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true. and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Girl, to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Please don't make me dream alone.
Sherilyn Wyeth with us. She is the author of Know the Name, Know the Person, Decoding Letters to Reveal Secrets Hidden in the Names. The book explores numer. You know what, Sharon? I can't say that word. What is that word?
It's nemology.
Nemology.
It's just with a Latin spelling.
Oh, I got it. Okay, so it's nemology. By the way, what a phenomenal thing to take a look at. I've heard of numerology, astrology, and the rest of it. But nemology, and I'm sure it's as old as anything can possibly be. What was it that got you involved and interested in it?
Well, I was an eighth grade math teacher in San Antonio, and I was ready to start my seventh year of teaching. And I was looking at the list of students that would be mine for the year, and I was making seating charts. And I realized that I was making judgment about the students based on their name. And at first, I felt really badly about that. But then I realized that there were reasons that I was forming these judgments. I noticed that kids named Joshua were usually really smart but obnoxious, and kids named Stephanie were normally stubborn. And as I looked at my list of unknown students, I started wondering if these kids coming into my class would manifest some of the traits that I associated with their names. So I did my best to be objective, and I really did see that the kids were acting out their names. And I noticed boys whose names started with J were often causing problems on the playground, and kids whose names started with S were really good at following the rules. And there appeared to be connections between the letters in a name and a person's personality. And these observations caused me to want to test this idea further about the names and the letter placements. So I decided to research to see if there was a correlation between behaviors and the letter in a name. I studied personality tests like Myers-Briggs and Jung. I studied the effects of sound vibrations because we hear our repeated all the time, and that effect on our brains at the Monroe Institute in Virginia, and how our brains learned and how learning occurred in our brains at Our Lady of the Lake, an attempt to find answers. And I was invited to speak to groups in 49 of our 50 states, where I continued to interview people and refine my theories on the importance of letters used in a name. But then I got really curious. Would these theories hold up in countries where English wasn't spoken, but they used our alphabet? So for 3 years, I went to over 70 countries and interviewed over 100 people in each country, over 7,000 people, just to see if letter combinations would bear out in certain personality traits, even when speaking different languages. And I discovered that they did. It didn't matter what language was spoken. With only a few exceptions, the patterns held. And that's why I created Nemology Science, and now I have people coming to me who want to increase their sales, executives who want to make sure they're hiring the right person, parents who want to understand their kids better. They're all coming to see how names can solve their problems.
You know, it's interesting because there are people who deal with numbers and astrology, and it seems to tie in, but that makes total sense. All right, let's get personal here. Let me get vulnerable to the world. Michael Ray Dresser, MichaelRayDresser. What's in a name?
Well, do you want me to tell you about your name, or would you like to give me a current problem that you'd like solved that's occurring with somebody else and have me compare your names and tell you how your names would give you the solution?
Oh, good idea. I'm trying to think of a problem.
It's nice when we don't have any problems in our lives.
I'm trying to think of somebody that there'd be a battle with. Here. Radio Susie. You're going to get yours. Okay. S-U-S-A-N. And the middle name is? Come on. You have to do the middle name. You can't do it halfway. F-E-R-N, Fern. Okay. And now, do you want her maiden name or her married name?
It doesn't matter. It all gives me different information. The maiden name tells me what her bringing up years were like, and the married name lets me know what her marriage and what her current life is like.
Okay. Now, her maiden name was Lubotsky. L-U-B-O-T-S-K-Y. And her current name is Greenman, G-R-E-E-N-M-A-N.
Okay, so what's the question? You want me just to compare the names?
How do I get her to quit throwing things at me across the desk? No,
Well, in Susie's name, first of all, she's really sharp. She can learn anything she puts her mind to, but she needs to have fun. If she's not having fun, it's not worth doing. And so she wants to play. Work is play. Play is work. And so she needs to do something like throwing stuff across at you, or give her something else that's fun to do at the same time, like a puzzle or something that's challenging, like come up with a joke about what you guys are talking about or a funny story. She's got to use her creativity. You, on the other hand, in your name, want to make sure that you stay in the lead, that you are family-oriented, that you're bringing everybody in, and that you're including everybody. And Susie's saying, I just want to play and have fun, and you can give me a little attention, a lot of attention, it doesn't matter. I just need to make work fun. And you're saying, but when we're doing that, we need to make it all-inclusive. Now, as you have grown older, or every year in your life, you would get more self-confident and more sure of yourself as you, you know, have more life experience. Where Susie, she was really serious more at the beginning, and she wants to play more as her life goes on. So we'd say you have to make deals. When are we going to play? When are we going to work? But it's got to be fun in the long run, or else she's not going to want to stick around.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. So effectively, the Michael Ray dresser, so it's called, are you saying it's got to be in control? No, that's a question.
I'm saying that you like to take the lead because you get your challenge that way. You want to be inclusive. Oh. Susie doesn't need to be the one in charge. She's more than willing to give you the lead as long as you're competent.
Oh, she just said, here, take it.
Exactly. She doesn't need to be the one in charge. She just wants to work for competency. And you've got that in your name, that you're capable of doing anything you put your mind to. So it's a good combination. And she's going to remind you to have the humor and not work too hard.
Okay, and by the way, life is fun, and it's what you want to make out of it. Let's go to some celebs now. Let's talk about Trump. Donald Trump, what's in that name? Because he's going to have an interesting 6 months to a year ahead of him.
Well, what's very interesting is you look at the individual letters, and they give you a lot of characteristics, but you also look at the word as a whole. And look at the last names represent our environment, where the first name is the essence of who we are. And you look at his last name, and it's Trump. He's going to trump everything. He's always going to rise to the top. It's in his name and the whole piece of it. And he's going to have a good time doing it because of where the U is in his name. So, and he's got to be anybody with a T at the front of their name. Okay, whether it's in their environment, name of their last name, or the beginning, either wants to be on top or on the very bottom. They can't stand being in the middle. And Donald's got all the work ethics of a CEO and a leader in his first name, but he also has a combination of LD in that name, which tells us that he always has to keep his anger or his temper under control when things don't go his way or the way he wants it. But he'll succeed. It doesn't matter what he does. He'll find a way. If he doesn't, you know, he'll figure it out. He's sharp. He's sharp. He's got a really reasoning mind. All of the letters say that he reasons everything out. He's very deductive, very logical, very step-by-step approach. He just has to watch his impatience with other people's, I don't want to say stupidity, but slowness, or if they don't catch on fast enough to what it is he's requiring.
Oh, interesting point. What about the Prez, Barack Obama?
Well, you know, an Obama in the last name, the OB says narcissism. So you have to decide, do I want do I want that in my environment or not? You know, some people say, yes, that's a motivating force. Other people say no, because it makes them self-centered. The B in a name, and depending on where the B is located in the name, says how much, but that is my mnemonic device is bigger, better, best. Those people are very competitive. And when you look at Barack Obama's name as a whole and also take into consideration his first name of Barry Satoru, it really says, I am so competitive, I'm going to do whatever it takes to make sure I end up on top, and it doesn't matter how I get there, I'm going to end up being the best because I'm going to make it happen.
Interesting point. You know, there's a couple of other people that are in the limelight, and one of them, let's go to Charlie Sheen for a moment. I don't even know what to say about this man anymore.
Well, we all love Charlie Sheen because of his last name, and you got that double E. And that is very appealing to a lot of people, especially if people have hurts or have emotional things going on in their own life. They can really identify with him. But in his first name, he tells us that he does everything the hard way. He couldn't do it easy if he tried. So here he's got this conflict between, I've got to make things hard, but people love me while I'm doing it. So, and he's got also in his last name that he needs freedom in his environment. Now, anyone who has an SH feels very important that freedom is available to them. And again, depending on the location of where it is, it's how important that is. And so if I was to counsel him, if he had come to me, I would say, let's look in the name and see why you want to make everything so difficult when it doesn't need to be that way, how we can simplify your life so you can still get your freedom, still get your needs met, but not have to make it as hard as you unconsciously do.
Interesting point. Let's go to the royal wedding, and I think that's going to be something that everybody's watching. Prince William and Kate Middleton. Kate Middleton came from nowhere, and all of a sudden, someday she's going to be the Queen of England. Is that something that's going to last?
You know, when I look at their names and compare their names, they have a fascinating interaction interchange. Like, William is all about family, and I've got to do my family expectations. I've got to come through, and I want to do a good job, and I want to be wise at this. But he's real slow at making a decision, and because he wants to make the right one the first time. He doesn't want to have to backtrack. He doesn't want to make mistakes if you look at his name. And he's very family-oriented and very people-oriented. And then you look at Kate. And Kate is a natural leader where William's had to work at being a leader. But Kate doesn't need to be the one in charge, but she's a workaholic, and duty for her comes first. So if William says, hey, we've got to do this, Kate's this workaholic behind the scenes saying, help me, let me help you. Let me help you get it done. I'm your workhorse. What do we need to do? And it's interesting to me how duty comes first for her. Relationships come second. You have to be dutiful first. And who do you want for a queen? You want somebody who can follow those directions but take the lead and who can know that duty is very important if you're going to future queen. And so if you look at their names all the way through and you watch how many letters match, especially in the vowels. Now, vowels represent emotions. And so you look at these vowels, and the Middleton has a lot of the same values that William has in his name. And it's how we communicate is all in our vowels. They have very good communication skills. They really get each other. And where Kate is a workhorse, she doesn't need to take things to the extreme. William, once he likes something, he really likes it and needs to take it to the extreme. But Kate's got tolerance written all of her name, and she also wants to be the very best she can be. So they're very compatible. They match in their communication, in their attitudes. They're very complementary to one another. So I would expect that this is a marriage that will have, there's very few things in competition or in contrast. So it's going to be a marriage that has very few disruptions, very few arguments. When they come, both of them are going to say, okay, we got to work our way through this. What do we need to do? Even if it's a timeout, we need to work through this. And both are very willing in their names to have that discussion and make new agreements. So I expect this marriage to be a very long one with very few problems that come apparent publicly at all.
You know, speaking about marriage, I imagine that if a couple met and they fell in love and they decided to get married, it would be very interesting to sit down with somebody like yourself and move through some of these things and anticipate some problems before they would even happen to make things last.
I had a couple when I was in Hawaii working this past fall. They had called me over there, and I sat down with a couple who was at a dating spot in their relationship where they said, we're either going to break up or we're going to go forward and make a commitment. And they came to me, and it was so interesting as I went through from looking at her name. I said, let me tell you what's hard on him when you do certain things, and let me also show you where that came from your upbringing, because it sits in that last name of your maiden name, your first, you know, when your parents' name. And she was so amazed. She was going, yes, I'm just like that. Yes, you're right. And she was just amazed at what I could pull out of a name. And then he just kept saying, okay, whatever, whatever, you know. But he was seeing that what I was saying about her was true. So when I came to him, I said, okay, are you ready to hear what bothers her about you and what we can do about it? And he just kind of looked at me, and he said, yes. And he kind of looked very hesitant. And I looked at him and I said, do any of your relationships last more than 3 years, or do they start breaking up at the two-year mark? Because in your name, it looks to me like you can go about 2 years and then you lose the women that you're interested in. And he gave me this very nervous laugh and said, that's what my friends all say, because my last 5 relationships all broke up around the two-year mark. And he looked at me, and then I had his attention, and he goes, why do you see that? And so I talked to him about this same CH that Charlie Sheen has in the front of his name, but other letters following through his name. And I said, you've got letter combinations in your name that say, I have to be right at all costs. I can never admit that I make a mistake. I don't know how to apologize. And a woman looks at that and says, you know, I can put up with some of that for a while, but once he gets to know me, maybe that'll stop. And by the two-year mark, she realizes that's not going to change, and I don't need to be with somebody who has to be right all the time. And that's when there's problems.
And by the way, did he turn it around? Was it possible for him to turn it around once he saw what it was?
We talked about it, and yeah, they talked about it for the next 5 hours. And I went to a play that night, and they happened to come up during intermission and see me and the people I was with. And they said that they had done nothing but talk for the 5 hours. It was the best conversation they'd had in years. And they had decided to break up because he did not want to change. He saw what he would need to do, and he said, it's too high a price for me to pay. And so I guess I'm just going to be alone in this lifetime.
Well, you know, one more couple, we've got about 3-4 minutes to go. I think it would be fascinating to do Bill and Hillary Clinton.
You know, let's look at their names and notice that both of them have a double L in the beginning in both of their names. And they also have the I. The ILL is in common. The more letters you have in common, the more you get the other person. Hillary's a fighter. She's going to fight and fight and fight and do whatever's necessary. Bill, in his name, is a charmer, and he wants to be charming and compassionate, and he's got that same B as Barack Obama, where he's competitive. He wants to end up on top regardless, but he's going to charm his way to do it, where Hillary's going to fight to get where she wants to go. They have the same communication style because of their similar letters in the same place. Both are very family-oriented. That first I in a position, just like in your name, Michael, where it has the first I, says family is all important. Whether we like them or we've got problems with them, that's who takes our attention. And as you're comparing Bill and Hillary, she wants to be treated fairly. And as long as she's treated fairly, she'll hang in there with them. And she has a need to be liked. And as long as he gives her some attention or meets those needs to be liked, you know, then she'll hang in with him regardless of what he does. On the other hand, when he looks at her, he says, anything that I mess up, anything that I screw up, she's going to come through because she's a fighter and she'll clean it up. So they have a great relationship with each other. It's very good agreement. I think that they really communicate well, and they understand each other, so it's a working team.
Yeah, that's one tough woman. That's one tough woman. Any way you look at it, she's tough. And when I say tough, meaning she can deal with things. She gets out there and she gets it done. She handles the pressure. But I think she's got to that point where after this go-around, I think it's over for her. Too much. And you can only handle so much in a lifetime. All right, we're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Sharon, is there a website we can find you at?
Two two websites, knowthename.com and bestmeanings.com. Know the Name is all about the book and what you can see in that book and different, all the radio shows I've been on, if you want to listen to any of them. And then on Best Name Meanings, you can go through and find out traditional name meanings and then how nameology is different and what we say about names.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been really great.
Thank you for having me, Michael. I've enjoyed it tremendously.
Take
and
care.
I've
good
got
night.
A gift for your readers. Anybody
oh,
that goes, your listeners, anybody that comes this next week and signs into either website, I will randomly pick a letter out of their name and let them know what that letter says about them.
Oh, looking good. Thank you so much. Take care.
My
good night.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And a hand of holding me begin to fall. And a loving burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore.
And welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And if the magic angel with the voice in my ear tells me that Kathleen Puckett's here, I'll go on with what I'm doing. Okay. Hopefully, we're going to keep our fingers crossed. Kathleen Puckett is back with his former FBI psychological profiler in the counterterrorism unit. The new book, the book is...
At Your Desk.
Wonderful. What is the name of the book, Kathy?
Hi, Michael.
Hi, and what is the name? Watch me get as much mileage out of this as we can. And what is the name?
Homeland Insecurity, Michael.
Oh, I love every second of that. My goodness. By the way, thank you for being with us and being with us and being with us and being with us.
My great pleasure.
I heard something very interesting today, and I was flashing by the news, and it happened so quick I couldn't catch who said it. But they said in the last 2 years with this administration, not one of the people had been caught that was involved with 9/11. And what was it? What did they say? It was or brought to trial or something. Well, don't we have somebody brand new in Pakistan?
Yeah, definitely. No. We have several people who had involvement with 9/11.
Yeah, and, but we can't talk to them.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is one of them.
Yeah.
There are people who, several of the detainees who were at Guantanamo Bay, were involved with the 9/11 plot. In fact, we have quite a few.
But there's
so as far as you're talking about conviction.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
As far as conviction is concerned, well, of course, we did have a conviction in the case in Chicago of. He was thought to be the 20th hijacker, and he was the one who the FBI agent made the guy who was a spotter and a part of the plot who let's see, I'm blanking on his name now. You know, we're having this disease, Michael, with our age. But anyway, he is in federal prison. He is in, as a matter of fact, I think he's in the Supermax along with, on Bombers Row because he was convicted.
Yeah, isn't there somebody right now in Pakistan that they won't let us get to?
Oh yeah, there are all kinds of people. Pakistan, you know, it's a very strange situation over there because, you know, extraditing someone, if you're not going to do what we did, which had kind of caused a kerfuffle about, extraordinary rendition, if you're not going to go over and grab somebody, then you have to depend on the good graces of the government that you're trying to extract the person from. And if there is not a reciprocal agreement on extradition with that government, then you really have no say. It's a matter for negotiation.
I want to go to issue because I think this is extremely important, especially, Kathy, in today's world, whereby if you say something, somebody's going to deny what's being said because of some political ideology or there is some agenda going on. Right now, we're talking about the Director of National Intelligence. A couple of weeks ago, he offered the analysis on the situation in Libya, and he said, I just think that from a standpoint of attrition, that over time, I mean, that this kind of a statement back and forth, but I think over the longer term that the regime will prevail. Based on that, National Security Advisor Tom Donilon got right on him and said, no, they deny it, and he didn't say it, and it doesn't work that way. What's the problem with somebody saying something that's the truth anymore?
Well, what's the problem with somebody saying, you know, the problem is that the truth is, by the way, it's Zacharias Moussaoui who's in prison as the 20th hijacker who is serving this sentence. Basically, Michael, you know, it's such an interesting question because you're really talking essentially about the state of the media at large right now. It's very interesting for people who are interested. What is the truth? I mean, there's a whole aspect of philosophy that studies, you know, what is the truth and what is not. And that's essentially the point of philosophy is to try to, you know, the whole practice and the art of philosophy is to, and the science of philosophy is to work out what is really true and what is not. And the relativism that is so prevalent now in our society makes it possible for everyone to assert whatever they want to. I have to say that this has been happening both on the far right and the far left in our country. And the far left is no less guilty of hyperbole and making up all kinds of outrageous allegations about the other side as the right side is. People talk about Glenn Beck being such an incendiary character. Well, you know, Keith Olbermann was saying the exact same thing on the other side.
No, by the way, the last thing I heard about Becky was now he's the Antichrist.
Well, yeah. Yes. He's really, you know, it's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what happens because now, you know, it isn't the world that we grew up in where there are three networks and then there are some little minor networks that play old cartoons and old shows and things. I mean, basically everybody's a media magnate if they have access to the internet and they can tweet.
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, basically Glenn Beck by not being on Fox, has no less a following than, I mean, he's going to continue maybe even more so because now there's no network oversight, you know, of what he's doing or saying. So, you know, there's all kinds of opportunity for people with very, very, very far reaching views on the far right and the far left.
Oh, sure. And there were two things that happened. One, from what I understand, his ratings dropped. And there was a comment about Obama being a racist against whites and so on and so forth.
Right.
So I think
comments, he goes, you know, he's never denied that he's an entertainer. You know, it's the same thing that Rush Limbaugh always says. You know, I'm in the entertainment business. You shouldn't take what I say to the bank. But there are a lot of people who do take it as gospel. And the problem is that when, you know, it's funny when you study United States, you know, we study American history and you look at old campaigns like in the, you know, Andrew Jackson campaign when he would come in and whip people with a cane and everything. People think this is rough politics now. It's always been a rough game in this country.
And now the Republicans are what? They're out there to kill women.
Oh, when did this happen?
You've heard that, haven't you? It's the Planned Parenthood thing.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well,
yes,
killing women, well, yeah.
To,
you know, that's the hyperbole. That's the, you know, if it can't just be that you can say it in a reasonable manner. You have to make it so outrageous that people will lose all kinds of common sense and rationality and scream something like, you're trying to kill women. Well, that's a ludicrous argument against anti-abortion people. Just like anti-abortion people are irrational.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about it. But the problem is there are people who listen to that. And that's one of the reasons why it's done over and over and constant. You give enough, you say something enough times, there are people out there who will start to believe. Let me tell
now,
you what my biggest concern is.
Do you remember, Michael? And, you know, it's been the same. It's been the big lie in Stalin's Russia. You know, you tell people a big enough lie, it's the big lie that they're going to believe it. The same thing was, you know, right before that in Nazi Germany, that, you know, with Joseph Goebbels was the master of that. And the interesting thing was that was before the social media that we have now. Now, you know, anyone can have access to any kind of haywire ideas and push them in a completely international context. You can say something that goes around the world in seconds.
Oh, absolutely. Today, especially, a millisecond and it's there. But I think my biggest concern about this, when I'm sitting back and I'm watching both sides, and I'm at a point now, I'm not sure what I am anymore. I've always been right to center. Not drastically, but right to center. And there are things on the other side that I believe that in my heart of hearts that should be, whatever that may be. But the point, I think, of contention is that we've got people battling back and forth to see who wins, and the average person is getting left out in the cold because it's not
that's
about
exactly,
you anymore.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you because the whole point is it's the battle and it's the contest that's become the prize. It's, you know, the interests of the American public are not even secondary. They're like third, fourth, fifth place to winning, like Charlie Sheen would say, which apparently he's not doing anymore. You know, winning the battle and losing, and you know, we're losing all kinds of wars here, and everybody's declaring victory in various battles. It's not really giving anybody what anybody needs to live a good life here.
Not at all. And the money that's being spent constantly. There was a Google search the other day for someone. Now this is government. Now there was a job available in the government, somebody to handle Facebook. Kathy was at $115,000 a year. So there's a tremendous. I know.
Well, whoever does that, Michael, is going to be the lowest bidder and not be very good at doing Facebook.
No, I got that loud and clear. And I think one of the biggest problem now is not necessarily money coming in. It's money that the government is spending. And I don't care who's got it, right, left, or indifferent, the money that's being spent. You know, every committee has a committee that's got a committee. And that's money for them.
The bureaucracy is ungodly. Yeah. And the bureaucracy is just fed by this political firestorm between the two. You know, there is, I think that with this latest budget battle, you know, where this hysteria that was going on, the whole, I guarantee you that every congressman in there and every senator thought that the eyes of the world were on them every minute of the time they were screaming at each other in session about the budget. And they don't understand that what people really want them to do is just shut up and get on with business.
Oh, no
they
question.
Really believe
no, by the
that
way,
they
no
are.
Question about, but look at the way they treat the constituency. Look at the way that they talk down to those people who actually vote for them. And there was one senator 2 weeks ago. I don't know if I mentioned it to you or not. I saw it, not hearsay. I saw it, and he was talking about he's tired of this silly Constitution. Why was he? And watch this go on. And he's still there, and he was a Democrat. That doesn't mean that a Republican wouldn't say that. That's not where I'm at.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
The point is that they've lost their focus, and that is a problem for all of us. And with Obama, good, bad, or indifferent, if anybody else would have said what I heard him say, I would have been saying this about them also. He was talking about, what was that shot about somebody in the audience had 10 kids, and he was talking about an SUV, and, well, if you've got 10 kids, you really should pay more attention to what you spend, how you spend it. And I'm thinking in my head, is he saying, yeah, get the plane ready. You see, they talk, they don't walk the walk. You know, and then,
It's yeah. like once you get to a certain place in politics, you are exempt from all the rules that everybody else has to live by. And they're just outraged that we all should expect them to play by the same rules that we do. This is a rarefied atmosphere. This is why dictators can be dictators for 42 years and think everything's just fine.
Yeah, and you got people like Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein out of California.
Oh yeah,
and they're saying, you know, it's for the poor and it's for this and the moms without food. These people are hundreds of millionaires. You know, it's called.
Oh, I know.
If you're going to say it, you know, be part of what you're talking about. If you're not part of the
exactly
problem,
walk the walk. You know, it's interesting, Michael. Have you ever seen that? It's on the House and Garden television channel, which I often retreat to get away from politics, and not a free commercial, but they have something on there called Selling New York, and it's very interesting because it shows the rest of us how a very, very tiny slice of people in this country live, and it's unbelievable. Nobody can relate to it.
Oh, I mean,
absolutely. These are palaces, $25 million condominiums.
Yes. I mean, you guys, you know, Charlie Rangel's been on back and forth. He lives the good life also.
See,
and that's the key. If you're going to speak for the poor, if you're going to speak for the middle class, my goodness, you know, give something up on your side already. That
right.
Doesn't
walk
mean that
that walk. Exactly.
Yes.
I'm with you, Michael. I'm with you. Yeah. The hypocrisy in politics and the media is pretty tough to take sometimes.
Oh,
which
no
is
question.
Why we wrote our book.
Yeah.
Homeland Insecurity, How Washington Politicians Have Made America Less Safe.
And by the way, are they politicians or statesmen, statespersons? How's that?
They would love to say they're statesmen. Oh, excuse me. Yes, statespersons. Yeah.
Statepersons. We're going to be politically correct here. It was like Sarah Palin. When Sarah Palin was governor of Alaska, she was a statesman, to cover both men and women. What she mm-hmm. did for that state, I don't know if she'd make the greatest president in the world, but that's neither here nor there. But what she did for the state of Alaska, there is a dividend that everybody gets. And it's, let's say,
mm-hmm.
a five-year average of what the profitability is of the oil companies, and everybody gets a piece of that, which ends up to be anywhere from $900 to $1,200 a year per person in your family. You got five
which
kids
really helps. Yes.
You get. Okay. She went up against the oil company. She went up against the Republican Party. She fought, and she fought for the people of the state of Alaska, and she actually got the dividends and the rest of it increased. That's
but then
a
look
state's
what happened, Michael.
Pardon?
Then look what happened. Where did she want to go next? She wanted to go further up the political ladder.
Absolutely.
And she started making compromises.
Yeah, by the way, she started out as a PTA mom. Did
oh,
you?
Yeah.
That's how she went from committee to committee. She worked her way up. Now, obviously,
I know you interviewed her.
She ran for vice president, and then she's a rock star now. There's no question about it. But
right.
That was
and
when
she has lost the perspective. Don't you agree that she's lost the perspective that she had when she was starting out in Alaska with local politics? This is the problem.
Yeah.
This is the problem of the political process.
I've interviewed people that said, I'm tired of it, I'm angry, and I'm going to run for an office. And they had that behind them. They didn't know about that word that has to do with collectively everybody getting together, and you just don't do what you want to do. It's called consensus. All right. Now, I've watched them get involved, and I've watched the personalities change over the years.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And there's a euphoria, Kathy. It's like a drug.
It is a drug, which is why we called it an addiction to political power in our
power
book. That's exactly what it is. It is a drug. It operates on the pleasure centers in the brain just like a narcotic does.
Absolutely. I'm going to get into office, and then I got a dopamine rush.
Well, I will vote for you.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that's something I wouldn't do to me or anybody else. Let me tell you right up front. because it would be different if you could walk in and be able to get something accomplished. You can't.
Well, like citizen politicians, like you were only allowed. I mean, couldn't we do a lot to stop this by doing term limits?
Absolutely.
It's such a dirty word.
Okay, but let me tell you what I would do if I was king of America. They would not like me in the beginning, because the first thing I would do if I had the absolute power and the say and the oversight over everything, I'd pull everybody that's an American citizen back into the country from everywhere in the world. Then I would build a 30-foot fence, 50-foot fence around the border. And then I would start, and I would pull all our military, National Guard, everybody together back here. Then I would start at the border, and I would start working my way in. And I would go to the inner cities, and I would clean them up. And I'd get rid of the gangs. And I'd get rid of the corruption. I'd get rid of all of that violence, okay? And
where
once
would you
that
get the money?
Done,
the money's all in China.
I'm king. I can print it. Okay.
What
do you need money for, right? But I'd clean it up. And then once it was cleaned up, then I'd open the borders back out, and then I would move out. Because my contention is if you don't have it cleaned up here, if you can't walk down the street and feel safe, something is very wrong. So I think our focus should be here and then move our way out.
I agree with you. It's probably true that we should mind our own house first. But I tell you what would happen to you, Michael. You would be surrounded by all kinds of sycophants who would say, Michael, you can't leave us now in our hour of need. You've made all of these advances for us. You're the only politician that we can trust. You can't go away now.
And I'd say,
brain start to think?
But you weren't looking at me. I had my fingers crossed behind my back when I said it. Kathy, we're about out of time. Do you have a website don't vote for me because I'm not running. Do you have a website?
HomelandInsecurityTheBlog.com, Michael.
Wonderful. I'm going to sit right here. I'm going to wait for you until next week.
Look forward to it.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Carrie Patterson is with us, and the name of the book is Change Anything, The New Science of Personal Success. You can change anything when you want to change it. All three authors, Carrie Patterson, Joseph Grenny, David Maxfield, Ron McMillan, and Al Switzer, are three-time New York Times bestselling authors, world-class speakers, leaders of Vital Smarts, a state-of-the-art innovative training company that has taught 2 million people worldwide. Vital Smarts has consulted with more than 300 of the Fortune 500 companies. And let's say, Carrie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, you can change anything anytime you want it. Carrie, I imagine you just have to have the want to change. There's something I heard years ago, and I think it just stays so true with many people. Rather be unhappy than unsure.
you know what's interesting? We started by trying to figure out why people were unsuccessful, and we studied 5,000 people who were successful, and it turns out they all shared one thing in common. One, they had failed, and two, they found a way out, and what they found was they couldn't do it just through willpower. People have to escape the willpower trap. Assuming that you can overcome anything from spending addiction to smoking to drinking to sycophancy at work. I just heard the previous person talking about that. You can't do it just by gutting it out. That's the first thing we learned.
Now, by the way, when you talk willpower is based on something we've learned to do or not to do, no willpower. So there's got to be something deeper than that. There has to be some kind of a behavioral change, some kind of a shift in the way you think to be able to take your first step on the path of change.
That's correct. It's interesting, when we first talk with people, they would almost always attribute their change to an epiphanous moment when they had this sort of rock bottom, you know, come to the Lord experience and then decided to change. And yet when you probe further, you found out that they'd had similar rock bottom experiences maybe 10 or 12 times. The difference was they were able to find at least 5 or 6 methods that would help them change. The world is perfectly organized to generate the behaviors we're currently doing. And so if we're a person who's spending all the time, there are lots of forces out there. People who put 5 or 6 of those together were 10 times more likely to change.
Okay, so in essence, it's not just that one driving force. You know, if you want to define habit, habit is repetition of action, you know, and it's behavior, how we think, how we feel, how we act towards something. And these aren't things that are inherent in us. All of these are learned responses. And I really truly believe in my heart of hearts that if you can learn something, you can unlearn and you can relearn.
That's correct. I mean, if you look at the human being, other than sort of, you know, rooting, which is the head turning towards, you know, a movement when they're a newborn, almost nothing else is instinctual. It's all learned. And so it's a question of unlearning it. People we studied who were able to change looked at the world around them and said, we've got to structure it differently. We can't just gut it out. If you're gonna lose weight, you're going to exercise, just suddenly deciding, yahoo, I'm going to do it, and, you know, hunkering and down and doing it, not enough. So they have to learn, you know, new behaviors. They have to learn new skills. They have to take friends who are really actually accomplices and turn them into friends. They've got to structure the world around them differently as well.
You know, the word that I have found, if somebody wants to change, and I think mentor is a very powerful word. You need that extra set of eyes looking and seeing the things that you don't see, the things that you miss, and is bringing that quote-unquote invisible up to the table. And I think that in and of itself has got to be one of the first steps. It's not what we don't know. It's what we don't know that we don't know, Gary.
Yeah, you know, you're right. We're on the wrong side of our eyeballs more often than not.
Yeah.
We can't see some things that outsiders can do. If we can take people who are currently encouraging us to do the wrong thing and discouraging us doing the right thing, these people are accomplices, not friends. Sit down with them, hold what we call a transformational conversation, ask them to be your eyes and ears and to help you move in the right direction. They're the people who say, you know what, maybe we ought not eat this. You know what, maybe we ought to exercise. You know what, maybe we ought not spend this. You can turn accomplices into friends, and that takes you on the trip to change a lot faster.
You know, I think a very important word is influence. You know, one of the things that I know you addressed, that, you know, changing the influences around us by helping us to change the behavior. And I think really what it boils down to this, if I'm standing in a group of people and you walk up and you smack me right in the nose, I can't stop you from hitting me, but I can choose how I want to deal with it. And I think that's really what it's all about. We don't feel that we have choice in the options of dealing with the things we're confronted with.
Yeah, you often hear people saying things like, you know what, that person really made me mad. Well, they may have done something, but you chose to get mad on your own. You chose to sort of interpret things in a negative way. Of course, they smack you in the nose. It's hard not to. But
yeah.
Even under normal circumstances, when someone does something that's questionable, we tend to assume the worst of them, take it in the most personal and awful way, and then become upset, and we do it by the stories we tell ourselves. Tell different stories, you have a different set of assumptions, you don't get angry, and you don't get mad.
Yeah, and basically, I think that's really where it is. It's in that shift in how you think. Now, when you did the research, was there something within that research, this overarching theme that came up in front of you that surprised you because you weren't aware of it?
We were surprised by the number of people who believed that they could only change by gutting it out and using willpower, and who then found that they were blind and outnumbered, that the friends around them were working against them, that the environment, the physical environment, the physicality. I'm trying to lose, I've lost 60 pounds. The structure of the world around me was bad. I had huge plates, big serving serving bowls, and big serving spoons and whatnot, and I had to put my kitchen on a diet. I had to change my physical world. All of these become part of and parcel of a change process that involves changing 7 or 8 things around you. And then when that happened, once again, they were 10 times more likely to change.
You know what I've seen, Carrie, over the years, that if you meet somebody for the first time, they may think they're hiding from you, but they're not. You can see exactly what they are, how they're going to respond to things, and before they even say hello half of the time. And I really believe that if somebody's going to apply for a job, lose weight, do whatever, and they're trying to hide from somebody, it doesn't work. You wear it out there. You wear your heart on your sleeve.
Well, with our friends, particularly, we have an experience. We're quite likely to know, you know, in what way they're going to help or hinder us. So if you watch someone who's, you know, in our book, Change Anything, we looked at people who were facing strong addictions. And those who had a friendship group around them were very unlikely to ever break out of it until they distanced themselves from friends who wouldn't change and turned their other accomplices into friends. And so we know who they are. We know the conversations we need to have. We need to hold those. Otherwise, we can't change. They just hold us in our old patterns.
No, but by the way, the Change Anything approach is so many people today, especially we're living in a very hard and an unstable marketplace. And there are people, businesses who have to do more with less to deal with. And there's customers out there that have less money to spend. So using the Change Anything approach, the plan in and of itself, how does that help us look at our finances for the year?
Well, for one, when you're in an environment where you're having to cut back, you're going to have to get a lot more engagement and a lot more involvement from your employees. One study we conducted, 50% of the employees said they did the least amount possible to avoid getting fired. In other words, they were doing precious little. Another group of people we studied, there were over 70% who were spending a huge amount of time on the Internet and text messaging and whatnot. To re-engage your employees, you're going to have to find a way to help them change bad habits they've developed. They've got habits of checking their email every few minutes. With friends, they've got habits of not working. They check. They go out to the Internet, and you're only a click away from being in a dance hall or an auction or whatever you want to go to on the Internet. To change those kind of habitual and negative behaviors, you've got to take a strong approach to help them overcome the forces around them.
And now, you know, we look at the world today, especially the world of celebrity. You know, the Lindsay Lohans, the Charlie Sheens, the rest of them. Who, in your opinion, is not taking the right approach to do the change?
Well, anybody who's looking for a silver bullet, who goes off to, you know, a two-week workshop or in-depth experience, and then returns to their old environment with the same structure, same friendship patterns, same home, same route to work, they're about 95% likely to fall back into their old habits. Only when people take a long, hard look, develop a detailed change plan that involves at least six or more elements to help them change, will they actually be able to succeed.
I think one of the motivating factors for Charlie Sheen was when he started out, he was getting $300 a seat, and now they're giving him away, and maybe he's getting $20 a seat. That's a motivating factor to change. What your behavior is not quite working. Okay, there's that. There's that crucial moment. What is it?
Well, when we're trying to figure out how to change, we have to become the scientist in the subject. That is, no one's going to hand us a perfect change program just designed for us. We have to study ourselves. First thing you look at is look back at times when you sort of fell off the wagon. If you're a person who's having trouble controlling their spending, what was it that drove you into spending? Those are your crucial moments. Once you've identified them, you identify two or three behaviors that will get you out of it. So, for example, we're talking with a guy named David who's was spending, you know, his life away and sort of said, you know what, I'm going on a walk, you know, to get fit in the mall. And I walk by those windows and see all those things, and I start spending. I've got to not do that anymore. And you've got to look back, do what's called negative deviance. When did I do the wrong thing? And then identify what skills you have to bring to play to make sure that never happens again.
Okay, so in essence, it's really being mindful of yourself at the same time. There's most people who go through life, they make mistakes, they don't change, they keep on that same old pattern, but they're not looking at it themselves. So from what I'm hearing you say, the first step to do any kind of a change, the program, the pattern, is to step outside of yourself and take a look at how you respond and how you do things.
Yeah. And if you look at, you're suggesting some celebrity, someone gets paid, I won't name who it was, but she got paid $70,000 for every pound she lost. Well, guess what happens? Of course, she loses her weight, and then she takes her money, and then she balloons back. She does a quick analysis of herself and says, you know what, if all I do is get money, I know what I'll do. You know, I'll lose it, and then I'll put it all back. Has to stop, take a look, and say, how do I have to behave differently in other scenarios as well? I have to change many factors in my life. If not, I'll never be able to maintain my change.
And, And then she becomes a star on Dancing with the Stars.
We're not going to say what they're talking about. You know, and this is not a knock on her. This is a knock on the whole process of saying, we'll just change a single variable. We'll give her a lot of money. We'll have this person go off to this workshop. We'll have them do this, you know, fill out this report. Once again, people who brought six or more sources of influence on themselves were 10 times more likely to change and to maintain that change for 3 or more years.
Yeah, but realistically, you have to want the change, don't you?
It starts with that. I was watching the Final Four the other night, and Bobby Knight, who I have to say is not one of my favorite role models of leadership, but he did say one thing I do agree with. He said, "The will to plan to win is more important than the will to win." Think about that. The will to plan to win is more important than the will to win. What he meant was, you can't succeed unless you do some detailed plans and stick with those. And that's kind of grunt work. That's, you know, as you were suggesting earlier, being introspective, stopping, thinking about yourself, studying yourself, stepping out and taking another look. That's what leads to success. You've got to be willing to do that.
Yeah, Kerry, and it's also recreating definitions in your life. And I think definitions define how we define something, how we perceive something, is the way, the end result of everything that we do. So a lot of what you're saying here also that I'm hearing is not only do you have to step outside and take a look at yourself, you have to redefine not only yourself, but what different things mean to you. And as long as I have a definition of, let's say I'm overweight, then if I've got that definition of it's comfortable for me, it's safe for me, etc., there's nothing that anybody's going to do to cause me to lose weight until, one, I decide I wanted to do it, and two, I have to redefine what that weight means to me and then redefine life. So it's a process of taking a look at it and turning it around.
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that happen with that self-definition. You know, when you look at the people around you and start accepting them, you don't realize they're serving as a model for who you are. If people around you are overweight, you're 75% more likely to be overweight than if the people around you are thin. People thought about that for a long time and thought, what are they doing, forcing food in them? No. When the people around you are overweight, it sets your expectations that that's okay and that's how people are. So your sense of self changes. And so that's a very important thing to think about. You have to redefine who you are relative to your goals rather than those just around you.
Oh, no question about it. And goals, et cetera, and especially today, I think why the window of opportunity for the work that you guys have done is extremely powerful. There's a lot of confused people out there. And if there's ever been a time in this country, except for the Great Depression, quote unquote, if there's ever been a time in this country for redefinition and taking a look at and talking about change, it's now. Because if you not to tough it out, not to do any of that, but to realistically structure, get a strategy of how to let yourself move through it, because those who will come out of this thing fine.
Yeah, you know, and you're right, these are tough times, and it does require for some cases a rebuilding of ourselves. One of the things that we were most impressed with was the difference between those who succeeded and those who didn't. One of the variables was those who were successful took a look at their default future. When you talk about your sense of self, they looked and said, who will I be 20 years from now if I don't change my behavior? And many of them, I'm a baby boomer. I have, 20 million friends coming into retirement age, of which 85% of them are going to come in with Social Security and a bowl full of nickels.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, how could they have done that? They got PhDs in avoiding thinking about how they were going to live. Savvy people take a long, hard look and say, if I don't change, what will happen to me? And they use that. And once again, it's one of the sources of influence to get them to change.
Yeah, absolutely. We're starting to run out of time. Kerry, is there a website we can find you at?
ChangeAnythingBook.com. Our book just came out yesterday called Change Anything, so ChangeAnythingBook.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Kerry Patterson, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Don't desert us.
Then there's nothing in the world can hurt us long as we're singing our song. Some sexes with them.
Hey, thanks for joining us. And if there's a subject you'd like to hear addressed on the show or someone you'd like to hear interviewed, get a hold of Radio Susie. You can find her on the website, the homepage of the website, And you can find all of our guests on the guest page of the website. Thanks for listening. And if you're listening on the web, which most of you are, tell your local radio stations about the show. That's the way we grow. And that's what you call networking. And that, my friends, is a wrap.